Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 23. Edward J. Ahrens. No better example could be offered of Mary Baker Eddy's lifelong inclination towards endowing many of those who came to her aid with qualities they did not possess than that of Edward J. Ahrens. Ahrens was a Prussian who came to Lynn as a young man, working at first as a carpenter, but later opening a cabinet-making shop of his own. A stocky, glowering man, to judge from his photograph, with shaven chin overhung with a fierce walrus mustache, merging into luxuriant sideburns, which in turn run up and around into a veritable mane of dark hair. His whole face, his full lips and deep-set snapping eyes suggest pugnacity in a high degree and convey a strange impression of a mind hovering on the edge of imbalance. In the years before he met Mrs. Eddy, he was frequently involved in litigation. Indeed, he seems to have been one of those people for whom going to law about anything and everything had an inevitable fascination. Instead of being a last resort with Ahrens, it was apparently a natural first resort, and, as so often happens to such people, from claiming his rights under the law, he has been generally described as seeking much more than his rights. The line between this and plain fraud is not easy to draw. On June 24, 1876, Edward J. Ahrens was arrested in Lynn in connection with a notorious series of swindles carried out by a group known as the Gremlaugh White Gang, which operated in Lynn and Boston and further afield. Ultimately, the charge against him was withdrawn, possibly because he knew how to arrange it. But the suspicion remained, and from subsequent amazing events, which must be later described, the inference seems reasonable that he was intimately acquainted with the underworld of the New England seaboard towns. Ahrens entered one of Mrs. Eddy's classes in the fall of 1877, just after her break with Spofford, and very quickly established himself in a position of influence, not only with Mrs. Eddy, but with her husband. The source of this influence was, in all probability, his intimate knowledge of the intricacies of the law. Up to this time, Mrs. Eddy had never voluntarily resorted to court proceedings. Indeed, she seems to have had a very wholesome aversion to anything of the kind, and there can be little doubt that quite a number of her less scrupulous students had taken advantage of the fact, leaving their obligations unmet, and in some cases, failing to return money loaned to them for one purpose or another. To a man like Ahrens, such a number of unredeemed rights would be little short of shocking, and it was not long before he was urging Mary and Gilbert Eddy to turn over the various unredeemed notes and promises to him, and let him bring suit against the delinquents for recovery. In the third edition of Science and Health, published in 1881, Mrs. Eddy is evidently alluding to the circumstances when she writes, "In the interests of truth, we ought to say that never a lawsuit has entered into our history voluntarily. We have suffered great losses and the direst injustice, rather than go to law, for we always considered a lawsuit of two evils the greatest. About 2 years ago, the persuasions of a student awakened our convictions that we might be doing wrong in permitting students to break their obligations with us. The student who argued this point to us so convincingly offered to take the notes and collect them without participation of ours. We trusted him with the whole affair, doing only what he told us, for we were utterly ignorant of legal proceedings. Be this as it may be, in the February of 1878, Ahrens, on her behalf, sued Richard Kennedy to recover $750 upon his promissory note of 8 years before. In the following April, he actually sued two members of the first class, namely George H. Tuttle and Charles Stanley, for unpaid fees, and later still, Spofford, for breach of contract. All three actions were ultimately lost, but quite undeterred by such failure, Ahrens went on to consummate his masterpiece in the art of litigation, a suit against Daniel Spofford for witchcraft. He did not so style it, of course, but from the first announcement of the suit in the Newburyport Herald, it was so styled in the press, and the case subsequently became famous in the legal annals of Massachusetts as the Ipswich Witchcraft Case. Ostensibly, this case was an appeal to the court by one Lucretia L.S. Brown of Ipswich to restrain one Daniel Spofford, who, the complainant affirmed, was a mesmerist, from practicing his arts upon her and causing her great suffering of body and mind and severe spinal pains. Appropriately enough, the case ultimately came up for trial in the Supreme Judicial Court at Salem. The strange story is soon told. In her letter to Spofford from Fairhaven, in which she went into some details about the second edition, Mrs. Eddy mentioned a Miss Brown, whom she had restored to health, evidently from invalidism of many years' standing, the result of an injury. This Miss Brown is the Lucretia L.S. Brown in the case. Lucretia Brown was a spinster about 50 years of age who lived with her mother and sister in an old house in Ipswich, facing on Schoolhouse Green. It was a typical New England house and household, with an emphasis on neatness and order in itself and all its surroundings. Indeed, it used to be a saying in Ipswich in those days that Essex was the cleanest county in Massachusetts, and Ipswich the cleanest town in Essex County. And the Browns were the cleanest people in Ipswich. Miss Lucretia had suffered all her life from spinal trouble caused by a fall when a child, and although not actually bedridden, she was often confined to her bed for weeks at a time, and never could walk further than around the house or across the green, or on her good days, to church. In spite of all her handicaps, she had built up, with the aid of her sister, a crocheting agency, taking orders for city dealers. It was the period when, crocheted antimacassars were everywhere. And giving out piecework to the ladies in the village who desired to earn something in their spare time. Miss Lucretia was noted for her system, from which she never deviated. At exactly 2 o'clock in the afternoon on certain days in the week, she gave out the crochet work. Those who arrived before that hour assembled in the parlor, and exactly on the stroke of the hour, the door leading into Miss Lucretia's bedroom was opened, and the ladies admitted, one by one, in the order of their arrival. She received them in bed, whereof the turned-down sheet, the counterpane and pillow, were always so incredibly white and smooth as to arouse comment as to how it could possibly be done. Even when the last lady had taken her order and gone her way, after all the yarn had been handled and the directions given, the bed was still as unrumpled as ever, and Miss Lucretia still as neat and prim. Miss Lucretia had been healed by Mrs. Eddy. There was no doubt of it. She was able to be up and about the house all day, and on several occasions, to the amazement of her friends and neighbors, had walked distances of 2 or 3 miles to make an afternoon call on days when she was not receiving. The healing of Miss Lucretia Brown was everywhere the talk of Ipswich and the neighborhood. Then, one day, she had a relapse, and when, in great fear, she appealed to Mrs. Eddy. Mrs. Eddy sent her loyal friend, Miss Dorcas Rawson, to see her. Miss Rawson was usually very successful, but she could do nothing with Miss Lucretia, who, baffled but determined, took to her bed again. It was just at the time when the Spofford controversy was at its height, and the alliance between him and Kennedy had been suspected. The fear of mesmerism, or malicious animal magnetism, as it was called, was everywhere. Mrs. Eddy could insist that forewarning was a complete protection, but her followers were not at all so sure. And when one day, shortly after Miss Lucretia's relapse, Daniel Spofford, for no apparent reason at all, called to see her, some of the students were in an uproar. No further explanation could satisfy them, save that Daniel Spofford was a mesmerist, and in order to have his revenge on Mrs. Eddy and her loyal students, had brought about the relapse of Miss Lucretia Brown, whose healing was such an outstanding instance of the truth and effectiveness of Mrs. Eddy's teaching. Mrs. Eddy herself had written in the Newburyport Herald that the time would come when the courts would take cognizance of the malpractice of the avowed mesmerist. And so, nothing would do, in Aaron's judgment, but that Spofford should be sued at once and enjoined by the court from further wrongdoing. To what extent Mrs. Eddy was consulted in the matter, if at all, until too late, is uncertain. She herself, in the third edition of Science and Health, declares that the case was brought into court contrary to her advice and judgment. But in any event, the bill of complaint was duly drawn up and presented. It is a strange document, and runs in part, quote, humbly complaining, the plaintiff, Lucretia L.S. Brown of Ipswich, in said county of Essex, showeth unto your honors that Daniel H. Spofford of Newburyport, in said county of Essex, the defendant in the above entitled action, is a mesmerist and practices the art of mesmerism, and by his said art and the power of his mind influences and controls the minds and bodies of other persons, and uses his said power and art for the purpose of injuring the persons and property and social relations of others, and does by said means so injure them. And the plaintiff further showeth that the said Daniel H. Spofford has at divers times and places wrongfully and maliciously and with intent to injure the plaintiff caused the plaintiff by means of his said power and art great suffering of body and mind and severe spinal pains and neuralgia and a temporary suspension of mind, and still continues to cause the plaintiff the same. And the plaintiff says that the said injuries are great and of an irreparable nature, and that she is wholly unable to escape from the control and influence he so exercises upon her, and from the aforesaid effects of said control and influence. End quote. The case attracted instant attention as soon as the bill of complaint was filed, and the Boston Globe sent a reporter down to Ipswich with instructions to interview Miss Brown. When he arrived, Lucretia was actually, or ostensibly, away from home, but he did succeed in seeing her sister, who was evidently most emphatic on the question of Spofford's delinquency. The lady informed the Globe reporter, the account ran, that she and her family believed that there was no limit to the awful power of mesmerism, but she still had some faith in the power of the law, and thought that Dr. Spofford might be awed into abstaining from injuring her sister further. That he does, so she believes, there is no possibility of doubt. In answer to a query put by the reporter, she admitted that should Dr. Spofford prove so disposed, even though he be incarcerated behind the stone walls of Charlestown, he could still use his mesmeric power against her sister. In due course, the case came up before the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts in Salem on May 14, 1878. Edward J. Ahrens appeared as counsel for the plaintiff, and as soon as Judge Horace Gray, who was to hear the case, had taken his seat on the bench, Ahrens arose and presented his petition for a hearing on the bill of complaint and made an exposition of the case to the judge. It was, more or less, of a routine. The judge ordered that a notice be served upon Mr. Spofford, and appointed the following Friday, May 17th, for a hearing of the case. On Friday morning, a great crowd thronged the courthouse, and the newspapers were evidently prepared to make the most of it. They were all, however, to be disappointed. The proceedings were brief and colorless. Spofford did not appear, but his attorney appeared for him and filed a demurrer, which Judge Gray immediately sustained, giving judgment that it was not within the power of the court to control Mr. Spofford's mind. Ahrens immediately appealed the case. The appeal was granted, but never prosecuted. There seems to be little doubt that, from the first to last, the whole strange proceeding was arranged and promoted by Ahrens as part of his singularly ineffective campaign to secure Mrs. Eddy protection for her teaching by appeal to the law. Mrs. Eddy herself, before she realized where this policy was leading, left the matter, she says, entirely to Ahrens. It was the first and last attempt of the kind, and on the whole seems to have had a very clarifying effect on the infant movement. The statement in the bill of complaint, to the effect that the plaintiff had no power to protect herself against the real or imaginary attacks of mesmerism, was exactly contrary to everything Mrs. Eddy was trying to teach. And the net outcome of the case seems to have been to convince Lucretia Brown and her friends that even if Spofford and his friends understood mesmerism and were using it or misusing it, they themselves had something better and stronger. Anyway, Lucretia recovered completely and carried on her business as before, with the single difference that she now received her ladies in the parlor instead of, as formerly, in her bedroom. She remained a devoted follower of Mrs. Eddy until her death some 5 years later. Meanwhile, although there is scant record of it, the new teaching was spreading rapidly and astonishingly far afield. Less than 7 years after the Ipswich witchcraft case, Mark Twain was to declare in something very like querulous amazement that he believed the new religion would conquer half of Christendom in 100 years. Science and Health, in spite of its apparently limited circulation and checkered history, was being read by an increasing number of people. The book had a way of traveling from hand to hand, one copy often making long journeys, being read in its progress by many different people, many of whom were to find, often weeks and months later, that it had unconsciously changed the whole course of their lives. Numbers credited to it healing of physical troubles or infirmities of long standing. The story of its odyssey, as it came to be pieced together in after years, is replete with testimonies of people who read the book, were helped by it, forgot even its title, who wrote it, or even who lent it to them, and then spent years in trying to find it again. But in these early years, not much of all this appeared on the surface. It was like the coming of spring in an ice-bound country. The work was being done underneath. The transformation was to come almost overnight. Mrs. Eddy, in the second edition of Science and Health, spoke of several cases of healing as the result of simply reading the book, while it was not long before letters to the same effect, still preserved, were coming in from practically every state in the Union and even from England and Ireland. Years afterwards, Mrs. Eddy was to place on record, as one of her findings, that students of her teaching, who were thus thrown on their own resources, precluded by place and circumstances from any appeal to herself or others, seemed stronger to resist temptation than some of those who have had line upon line and precept upon precept. And she added characteristically, "If they must learn by the things they suffer, the sooner this lesson is gained, the better." When, within a few years, Mrs. Eddy, her book, and her teaching had emerged definitely into the light of national knowledge, these people were all more than ready to move forward and enter with enthusiasm upon the missionary field. But meanwhile, in Lynn and Boston, the only record apparently unfolding is that of conspiracy and persecution, each one worse than the last. The witchcraft case was hardly out of the way before George Berry appears on the scene once more, this time in a role so entirely discreditable as to alienate from him any last vestige of sympathy. Possibly he hoped to regain, by his action, some of the influence and power he had once enjoyed. But if so, he sadly misunderstood the woman with whom he was dealing. He wrote to Mrs. Eddy, expressing regret for the course he had taken, offering to return the money that had been awarded him as the result of his suit against her, and proposing that she join with him in what was clearly no more than a disreputable plot to get rid of Richard Kennedy. Whether this letter had any connection with the amazing and inscrutable conspiracy which must next be related, it is impossible to say, but it certainly serves to reveal the character of George Berry as nothing else could. "It is evident to me," he wrote, "that you desire Dr. Kennedy to leave the city, and I think also it would be for your interest to accomplish this end. The relations between he and I are probably of a different nature from what you suppose, as I owe him a debt on the past, which, if driving him from Lynn will accomplish, it can be done. He thinks I am your greatest enemy, and favor, if either, his side. Let him continue to think so. It will do no harm. For my part, I rather a person would come out boldly and fearlessly, as you and I did, facing each other, than to sneak like a snake in the grass, spitting his poison venom into them he would slay. I have said I owe Dr. Kennedy an old score, and the interview I had with him last night has increased that debt, so that I am now determined, if it be your object also, as two heads are better than one, to drive him from Lynn. Why should we be enemies, especially if we have one great enemy in common? Perhaps we can be united on this, and the result may be that this city will be finally rid of one of the greatest humbugs that have ever disgraced her fair face. All this can be accomplished, but as I said before, it is necessary to be very cautious and not let our communication together be known, as a friend in the enemy's camp is an advantage not to be overlooked." In reply, Mrs. Eddy declined the proffered money, told Berry she would only help to do what was right, and would always be ready to help him to do that. And in the matter of his proposition regarding Richard Kennedy, recommended him to leave all such issues to God. Such a reply was certainly nothing if not restrained. That it was effective is evidenced by the fact that George Berry disappears now from the story and never returns. In any event, he and his affairs would quickly have been overshadowed by what was to follow, the arrest of Gilbert Eddy on the charge of conspiracy to murder.